Public Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. We're thinking through why we chose careers in service and what we've learned along the way. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Christian Lubeau. Chris is a former U.S. diplomat, Teach for America public school teacher, and associate commissioner in New York City's Department of Design and Construction. His diplomatic overseas postings include Haiti and Cuba, while his domestic postings include the U.S. mission to the United Nations in New York and Office of Mexican Affairs in Washington, D.C. He's currently a vice president at CASIRR. How do you say that?
Perfect. CASIRR.
Ah, cool. CASIRR, New York City's top-ranked government relations and consulting firm. So first of all, Chris, thank you so much for being here with me today. I'm really excited to talk with you about your life and your career.
Hey, thank you so much for the opportunity. And more importantly, thank you for doing this podcast. It's really a great service to people in the United States.
Thank you. I mean, it really is my privilege. I've learned so much from doing it, so I feel like the lucky one. But let's go way back and start where I always like to start, which is with your childhood. Where did you grow up? And who raised you? And how do you feel like all of that primed you for the career that you embarked on?
Sure. Happy to talk a little bit about that. I grew up in New Rochelle, New York. It's a suburb of New York City, a few minutes north of the Bronx. My late father was from Haiti. He immigrated to this country from Haiti, couldn't go back because of the dictatorship. My mother is from the very exotic locale of Pennsylvania. And they moved to New York in 1980. And my mother's mother, my grandmother, was from France. So I grew up in a very multicultural household. New Rochelle itself is also very multicultural and diverse in every sense of the word, socioeconomically, religious-wise, race, everything. So I grew up really in diversity was a part of our household. It was a part of the community. And the other thing that was a big part of the growing up with my parents was they were both in the health industry. And my father was a doctor in Manhattan for 27 years at the same hospital. My mother started off as a nurse at a different hospital, eventually became a professor at a small college in New Rochelle. And they instilled in me the importance of helping others. And my father always told me it's important to put your work first and to really make sure that you're doing a good job at work and that you're helping people at work. And so that's kind of the value set that I grew up with. I think it inspired in growing up in New Rochelle, where some of my friends had a lot of privilege, others had no privilege. I saw all sides of what it can be like to grow up in the U.S. And so it really inspired in me the importance of giving back.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think the early exposure to just diverse ways of living and schools of thought and experiences. And then the fact that so many people I talked to on this show were inspired by someone in their family who demonstrated the value of service and how this can be like a core part of not only your career, but your life. So that makes a lot of sense. And I think that's a really beautiful start. And then you went to college, right? How was college influential in shaping you?
Sure. And I would also just add too that I, you know, being a foreign service officer, you're moving around all the time. So while my parents and their work in the helping professions inspired me to also give back and live a life of service, I grew up in the same house my whole life until I went to college.
Wow.
So in some ways, I wasn't so prepared to be moving around.
You were very rooted.
I was super rooted. I was super rooted. But yes, I went to college outside of D.C., University of Maryland. The Iraq War was going on at the time. For me, Maryland was down south, coming from the suburbs of New York City. And I really found myself through a community group on campus called Community Roots. And Community Roots' mission was to unite the diverse student body at the University of Maryland to take positions that advanced social justice. So with the Iraq War going on, which at that time was a pretty popular war still in the United States, we took the position as a student organization that we found it to be unjust and unnecessary. And so we were very active in demonstrations in Washington, D.C., and in organizing on campus. And that really started to move from, you know, having parents who are in the helping profession to, all right, this is now getting active in government, even if it's from the outside.
Right.
And I saw the role that activism can play in terms of pushing government. And I think at that point, I started to really develop a philosophy that continues to, for me, this to this day, which is, I believe one of the best ways to bring about social change and to push our society in a direction that's more just is actually through working in government. And so I was in college at that time and really wanted to do Teach for America, again, because of going to public schools in New Rochelle, seeing all sides of the spectrum. Applied for Teach for America senior year. It was the only thing I wanted to do. And I didn't get it. And, you know, when I look back on my career, oftentimes I feel like I've been the second option or the second and I've had to like reapply or things of that nature. And I realized actually second best is pretty good. But two, it's also important, I think, to persevere and to never give up. And so
you also had an opportunity to test how much you really wanted that. Like, how much did you care?
100%. I think sometimes if you don't get something that you really want the first time, it really crystallizes for you how important it really is. And TFA was important for me. So I went to Venezuela. After undergrad, I taught English there and I was learning about the political situation. And then after some time there, I came back to New York and I reapplied for Teach for America. And this time I got in.
They're like,
and
this guy again, we better just let him in.
Exactly.
He's not going to quit.
He's not going to quit. No.
Yeah. So what was that experience like?
TFA was great. It was great because I moved to Miami. I lived in Miami for a few years. I felt like I made an impact with my kids, with my students. I taught social studies. And shout out to Florida because they have civics is a mandated class in seventh grade. We didn't have that in New York.
Okay.
There's no civics class in New York. You learn about civics other ways, but in Florida, it's the class for social studies in seventh grade. So I taught middle school social studies, and then my last 2 years, I taught high school history. And I'm still in touch with some of my, if I can say this now, favorite students. I wouldn't have said it at the time. And made great connections with other friends. And I think that one of the biggest takeaways it gave me was a life of service is really about being available and being open and being flexible. And with Teach for America, it's like Peace Corps in the sense that you tell them where you would like to go and then they tell you where they need you to go. And that's the same thing with the Foreign Service. You tell them where you would like to go and then they tell you that's nice, but this is where we need you to go. And Teach for America instilled in me the importance of being flexible and open. And I end up having a wonderful professional experience in Miami.
So then how did you end up deciding to join the Foreign Service?
I joined the Foreign Service because so as a teacher, I would have time off in the summer and I was traveling a lot. I went to Lebanon by myself to visit. And I remember having a conversation way up in the mountains of Lebanon with a gentleman from the U.S. who was in grad school at American and couple of years older than me, and he told me about this thing called the Foreign Service, which I had never heard of before. And I remember vividly this conversation going down the mountain of us two in the back seat and him explaining what it was and how his goal after grad school at American was to be in the Foreign Service. And so I went back to Miami. I applied for grad school in New York. I only applied for one school. It was Columbia School of International Public Affairs. I figured if I don't get in, well, I'll just apply next year, like with Teach for America.
Exactly.
And, you know, just continuing to strive for it. And I had the good fortune of getting in, but when they sent me the congratulations, they also sent me what the expected tuition was. And I said, I don't have the money in my bank account to pay for this. And so what sorts of scholarships are out there? And I thought back to that conversation in Lebanon. And my mom had a good friend whose son was a Pickering Fellow. So I talked to him about the Pickering Fellowship and the Foreign Service and what is that. And
yeah,
that's how I ended up eventually going into the Foreign Service. I applied for the Pickering and the Rangel Fellowship. The Rangel got back to me at first, and I moved home to New York to go to grad school, and then had a fast track to taking the test for the Foreign Service. Still had to pass the test, but got mentorship, professional development, and the Rangel program was extraordinary for me. It gave me so much.
That's amazing. And there are so many of these different programs and pathways, but it still feels like you have to really do some like heavy investigative work to figure out what's out there. I mean, I haven't been in high school for a while. Neither of us have, but I don't remember, even as a student who was really interested in foreign affairs at that time, like knowing a lot about these opportunities and what the different pathways into foreign service versus civil service versus contractor work might look like. And so I think part of this project is also illuminating a bit of that so that people who are listening can hear that there are a variety of ways to access these careers. And understanding that that's for a reason. Like, we want to bring in a variety of people who have come in different ways because they've come from different places and they bring different experiences and questions and insights with them. So I'm really glad that you're talking about this and that you were able to go to Columbia without crushing mountain of debt. I'm 37 years old and I actually just finished paying off my student loans this year from grad school. So, you know, it's a big deal and it's for many people a huge limitation on the choices that they can make in their own lives and careers. So I'm always happy to feature, you know, a story about how somebody found a way in and made it work. So then you went on as a Rangel Fellow and joined the Foreign Service. I think you said you had 8 years active. Can you tell me more about your Foreign Service experience and your assignments in Haiti and Cuba?
I love my time in Haiti and in Cuba. You know, I think that the State Department gave me a huge gift by sending me to Haiti. I really wanted to go to Mexico City, where I got married a few weeks ago.
Oh, congrats. That's amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, 3 weeks ago in Mexico City.
Oh, wow.
And that was my dream post. Because I really wanted to learn Spanish, and I thought Mexico was cool. But when my career development officer found out that I was Haitian American, it was everything from our conversation about learning Spanish earlier in that meeting kind of went out the window. And her eyes opened up; they almost came outside of her head, and she said, "Oh, okay, great." And from there, it was written that I was going to go to Haiti.
Yeah.
And this was a couple of years after the earthquake that killed 200,000 people, including family members of mine, a close cousin of mine.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. But this is why I say I feel like State Department gave me the biggest gift, because it sent me back to the country. I hadn't gone back since the earthquake. I was able to be with my family in a more intimate way, spend more time with them, bring joy to them. And most importantly, do really, really important work for the U.S. Embassy out there. I think that I encourage all Foreign Service officers and civil servants who are of a different heritage other than just the United States to go and work for the United States in your heritage country, because we bring a certain level of understanding and nuance that I think can really advance the U.S. foreign policy and represent the United States well. And so my charge was really to help stimulate economic investment in the country and create jobs after the earthquake. I went there with a really good friend who was at my wedding. He flew in from Cote d'Ivoire. He's at the embassy in Cote d'Ivoire now. He was in grad school with me. He was a Pickering Fellow, Chukwudi. And we were in the economics section together. And I loved my time. I felt like we were able to put the focus on job creation, not just simply aid, but actual economic development, which is important for the sustainable growth of the country and stability of the country. And then I came back from Haiti, and career development officer said, "Oh, would you like to go to Paris or Buenos Aires or Beijing?" Because, you know, Port-au-Prince is allegedly a hardship post. I had a wonderful experience, but it's supposed to be a hardship post. So you kind of had credit in the bank to be able to go wherever you would like for the second tour. And I said, President Obama had just announced that he was going to reset the relationship with Cuba. I had studied Latin American and Caribbean history in undergrad. That was my major.
Okay.
And I felt like, what an opportunity to be a part of history and to go to Cuba and help be a small part of restoring the diplomatic relationship with the country, which is a value that I hold really dear, the importance of countries working together. So
hence choosing to join the Foreign Service.
Exactly.
Okay.
Hence choosing to go to the Foreign Service. And so they sent me to Cuba, and there was some funny business going on in Cuba, as now is public. I was briefed on that before going down there and kind of given the option of not going. But I decided to go because I felt like it was important for the United States and for Cuba to work to improve the relationship. So I went down there. The thing that I'm referring to is what we called at the time acoustic attacks, what is now just simply known as Havana syndrome.
Right.
And I was doing immigrant visas, so I was helping reunite families that were separated between Cuba and the United States. And we were doing the congressional mandated 20,000 visas that we had to produce every year of family reunification. So I did that work until I didn't. The Secretary of State at this time now was Tillerson, ordered basically all but this like skeleton crew to return to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And because of what's now called Havana syndrome. So I came back. But it was
that must have been scary. Like, hold on a second. That must have been really scary because it was like a situation where I imagine people weren't totally sure what was going on. And I think if I was in that situation, I would be, I think I would be on guard enough that you might even sometimes imagine like that you're experiencing symptoms because you're hearing other people share that they are too. And like, there's all this fear, which is really the point of the weapon, right, is to create fear and panic.
100%. The point of the weapon is to create fear and panic. And I certainly had, one night psychosomatic symptoms where I thought I was getting hit by this thing. I had to get a hold of myself and realize, oh no, I'm just imagining things. It's not happening to me.
Yeah.
And I think that happened for a lot of my colleagues who had those sorts of psychosomatic symptoms. And I also think that some of my colleagues really got hit by this thing.
Yeah.
So it was scary, but...
But you didn't want to leave.
I didn't want to leave because I felt like I had a duty to do my small part in fostering closer ties between the United States and Cuba. And I felt like the work was really important to reunite families. Fathers.
Well, that's also so personal. Like some of the work that we do can feel abstract at times, but like consular work, which, by the way, I think it's really cool that Foreign Service officers, don't all FSOs do a consular tour? I think that's really cool because that forces you to really be in touch with like the deeply personal, deeply human work that the State Department does every day. And so I imagine that like contributed to the feeling of responsibility that you had because you're like adjudicating these applications that change people's lives every day.
I agree with you 100%. And I think it's really important that all FSOs do consular tours. I would also add that it's revenue producing for State Department and thus revenue producing for United States government.
Oh, interesting. I never thought about it that way.
Yeah. The applications, the fees that are paid. It's one of the few positions that is revenue producing. So I, it was very meaningful to do that work. We had some tough time. You know, I think the acoustic attacks was one thing. When you go to Cuba, you know you're going to be spied on in a very intimate and personal way. And if you're not comfortable with that, which is totally fine, then you just don't go. So I knew going into it that there was going to be a level of espionage. No one had signed up for the acoustic attacks, what became Havana syndrome. But I felt like, you know what, I have a tolerance for a certain amount of risk, and I'm willing to take some risks for the betterment of our country. The one thing I'll add, though, that I feel like does not get discussed from folks who are down in Cuba at that time is we got hit by a Category 5 hurricane, Hurricane Irma, 140 mile an hour winds. That was, for me, in some ways scarier than what became Havana syndrome, because I remember power and running water in Havana got knocked out for a week. I was showering at a friend's house, using candles at night when I would go home after work. And I slept in the embassy the night of the hurricane with a bunch of Marines. And I also want to shout out the Marines, because the courage that the Marines showed that night, with fire alarms going off all night and rain battering the embassy and stormy weather and flooding the next day, and in the morning a fire in the basement breaking out and flooding in the basement. The Marines showed the utmost courage, and they were 18-year-old kids, 19-year-old kids, 21-year-old. It was so inspiring to be there in the trenches with them. And I think that's a story that doesn't really get told enough when we talk about Cuba from 2016 to 2017, 18, I would say.
So
that in some ways was scarier than the acoustic attacks, but I was ordered to depart because of the acoustic attacks.
Right. And so then being ordered to depart, was there a lack of closure? Did you feel like being ordered to depart made it more difficult to wrap up that chapter?
Yeah, I think that being ordered to depart, I think what I told myself was, in the moment, when I look back on that time, I'm going to stay as long as I can. But when the secretary tells us it's time to go, I'm going to accept that it's time to go. But that's easier said than done, because none of us that were there at that time wanted to leave. And we had even organized internally to try and stay. And we had great leadership at the time. Scott Hamilton took up for Ambassador De Laurentiis, and both of those leaders were extraordinary. But when we came back from Cuba, I had, unbeknownst to me, I think I had a little bit of post-traumatic stress disorder. And I was a little short with friends and family, and irritated, very irritable, a feeling like, and I did feel like something was taken away from me and from us. As much as I had told myself in the moment, all right, if they call us back, then it'll be, it is what it is, as we say in New York.
Well, it's one thing to think something, but then to fully believe it and align kind of the head and heart, I think takes time sometimes. And like with PTSD, it's not like you necessarily know right away that you're dealing with that. I think sometimes it can take time before, when you're back in a safe environment and then your body realizes like, oh, I'm safe now. Now I'm going to feel all the feels and it comes back to you.
Yeah, for sure. It definitely takes some time. The department gave us some resources when we came back. They offered some counseling. We were all able to check in with the medical unit. But you're right. I think we didn't quite fully grasp the impact, psychological and emotional impact, that that experience had on us.
Yeah. Well, really quickly, just returning to like the consular work that you were doing. I told you this in a previous conversation. I spent 8 years working for a law firm on immigration. So like I was a paralegal preparing the petitions that people at USCIS were adjudicating and helping people through visa processing, giving them like advice and prepping them for their interviews and answering their questions. And so I know what a personal and what an anxiety inducing process that is for people. For many, it's like the opportunity for their family to be together or not. And so thank you for your work, particularly in that area, because I think it does take an emotional toll, and it takes a special person and a high level of not only knowledge of like the laws, but also of emotional intelligence. So thank you for doing that work and absorbing all of that.
I appreciate it. I was just doing my small part, and thank you for the work that you were doing at the law firm. My wife is from Brazil, and we had the good fortune of meeting at work. She was supposed to be here only for a year. And we met, and things have unfolded, and we're now married, but we're going through her green card process.
So
we're working with immigration lawyers and paralegals. So I want to say thank you to you as well.
Of course. It's really rewarding work, and I actually tell people, like, including people who are aspiring public servants or who have already served, that I loved working at a law firm and found it really rewarding to do that work. I recommend it, and I'm happy to talk to people if they have questions. But I want to hear about the next chapter when you return back to the States, because I know that then you worked as a special assistant to Ambassador Nikki Haley at USUN. I worked closely with USUN quite a bit when I was at the State Department because I was in the Bureau of International Organizations. So for those who don't know, like, we're the Washington hub that like provides, we're basically like home base and USUN's our post, but in New York and not overseas. So what was that experience like? What was going on at the time?
Yeah, well, it was a great experience. I just pinch myself because I feel like I've been so lucky in the Foreign Service. I had a lot of great tours. It was a unique experience for me because I was working with political appointees.
Mm-hmm.
And political appointees come in for a couple of years. They serve at the pleasure of the president. Mm-hmm. And then when the president is gone, they're often gone too. So my job was really to act as a bridge between the career folks, civil service, foreign service, other agencies there, and the political team of Ambassador Haley. So I was charged with bringing her paper, her briefing books, her talking points, her speeches, working with the 110 or so people that worked in the embassy to craft those points, craft those papers, and make sure we could get that up to her in a timely fashion. And understand. I think what that required is really understanding her views and understanding when she liked to receive things, understanding how she spoke.
Yeah.
How she delivered speeches.
Yeah.
And also understanding what are the pressures and priorities of, as we called it, the 21st floor, which is the floor where the ambassador and other executives sit at the U.S. mission to the U.N. So it was really interesting work. It was a unique tour for the ability to work with the political appointees. I think that's important to note as well, whether you're civil or foreign service, you serve. You're bipartisan, as you kind of hinted earlier. And so we serve for Republicans and Democrats.
Right.
And that's what I did. But to continue on my theme of second choice and second best, I actually applied for that role and then was told I wasn't chosen. And I said, okay, great. I had an offer from the Operations Center in Washington, D.C. to go work in ops.
Yeah.
And which is also a fantastic job. So I told ops that I was going to take the position. And then that same afternoon, USUN came back to me and said, actually, if you're still available, we would like to bring you up. So I decided, okay, this is a dream opportunity. Growing up in New York, I admired the United Nations.
Yeah.
In part because of its multiculturalism. And so I told ops, I'm so sorry, there was a little bit of a misunderstanding. Seems that this position is still available and they would like me to come up. But I think they had asked someone else to do it and that person actually, they decided not to do it. So I was second best and ended up working out totally fine.
Yeah. And then while you were there, what kinds of issues were you working on? What was going on at the time that kind of like shaped your experience?
Yeah. So when I was, that's a great question. This was 2018 to 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it was countering Russia. Mm-hmm. And it was also thinking deeply about China and China's work, not just in East Asia, but also on the Security Council and also in the UN system in terms of appointments.
Yeah.
And it was also a lot of peacekeeping. There were about 10 different peacekeeping missions at the time.
Yeah. And I remember Ambassador Haley was really interested in like reforming our approach to peacekeeping.
100%. And I think that's part of the job that we both had at State, especially with appointees. It's explaining, you know, what's been already been tried before. And what are the lessons learned so that the political appointees can go out and more effectively execute the strategy that they want to execute?
Because
often we have that that institutional knowledge from our experience. I would say that it was a great job. It was a great opportunity working closely with the ambassador. My second year was in some ways more substantive because my second year was on the Security Council. So I was the U.S. negotiator on anything related to peacekeeping matters, gender equality, the African Union, protection of civilians. So that, what I always say about my tour at USUN is I became such a better diplomat because one, I was working with people who for the first time were not WHA. They were all over. Mm-hmm. So I was having more experiences to pull from. All these folks were older than me. They had more time in the State Department. And there's nothing like being at the table and being in a live negotiation and having to think on your feet, reading the room, understanding where the alliances are forming in the moment, where are the coalitions forming, what is this country, what is Russia going to say if I bring up this talking point in regards to the importance of gender equality. And I became a much better diplomat serving in USUN.
Yeah, and the Security Council is where like so many different geopolitical dynamics end up playing out, sometimes in these super technical documents. Like I was a policy advisor on several peacekeeping missions. So we would be the ones that would like come to an agreement in Washington on what our strategy and approach is going to be to a particular mission's renewal. What are our priorities for that mandate? And then we would send those instructions to New York. And the negotiators in New York would be the ones that give us feedback on tactics. Like, what's actually possible? What are they really hearing in those conversations that you just described? And I loved that process. And it was so challenging and so eye-opening.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, being totally, fully aligned with IO in Washington is really important for USUN.
And hard.
And hard.
Yeah. Because there's just different viewpoints, different vantage points. So naturally, there's going to be questions about like what's the best approach on a particular issue.
100%.
Yeah. Okay, so you were in New York. Then was that your last assignment before you left the Foreign Service? What was that process like? How did you decide to leave? And what have you been doing since then, kind of in a nutshell?
Sure. There were two things that happened when I was at New York that got me to start thinking about taking a sabbatical, if you will, without pay. COVID-19 hit, and the hospital I was born in essentially turned into a morgue. The hospital I was born in Manhattan.
So New York was hit so hard.
Yeah, New York was hit very hard. I got instructions from the White House at the time to negotiate language into a resolution that would refer to it as the China virus, which I found to be xenophobic, frankly, and not aligned with my values. But it started to become apparent to me that it was going to be time to take a break. And so I continued the tour. I finished it. There was some with George Floyd also getting killed. I can talk about that later on, but that also caused me to reflect. And I did another tour in the Office of Mexican Affairs, but which is a DC-based job. But because COVID had hit, I did it from New York, so I was working remotely.
Okay, tell me about the George Floyd time and how that affected you.
Well. I think in the Foreign Service and at State Department generally, but particularly in the Foreign Service, there's not a ton of people of color, despite the fellowships that we have and despite the opportunities that exist.
Yeah.
So George Floyd really kind of made, I'll speak for myself, it made me feel very heightened about my identity and some of my family members I think it caused us to really, frankly, organize. And we started the USUN's Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Council to make sure that there's a platform for talking about these issues and talking to ensure that people of color, women, first-generation Americans had a seat at the table and were recognized. So that was something we did. And I think the thing that was most paradoxical was we were negotiating. I was negotiating to resolve intractable crises happening halfway around the world in Sudan, for example, through a peacekeeping mission. That was my day job. But it almost felt like at night I had another job, which was to go out into the streets with New Yorkers and to let our voice be heard, organizing, activating, manifesting, demonstrating. And I felt that I was tied to both, that both were equally important, that we have ideals to live up to and to push in the UN system.
Yeah.
But we're also still a project that we are trying to perfect, and
yeah.
I'm going to play a role in both. So it was quite interesting tour. It ended up in an unusual, in a way that I didn't expect, let's say.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, working on UN stuff, we talk about red lines all the time. Like, what are true red lines? And I think a theme that has come up with others on this show has been, first of all, you're nonpartisan, so you serve whatever, you know, are the goals and priorities of the administration that is in power at the time. And you also try to apply your expertise to contribute to conversations to help formulate policy that you think makes the most sense. But you're going to win some, you're going to lose some. But everyone has their own red lines. And so you also have to be really honest with yourself about when those lines are crossed and when you can no longer feel fully invested in the work that you're doing, or whether you feel that maybe it's just a season where you need to do that work elsewhere. And that's why I like this project. It's an opportunity to talk about service in so many different ways and to be really open and creative about what service looks like for people who feel called, because I think once a public servant, always a public servant. So how are you serving in your new capacity? What's this journey been like?
Sure. The journey was scary at first, because I'm not a risk taker professionally, and I like that in government I could have done a career for 30 years as long as I was continuing to advance and,
sure.
and have accomplishments because of foreign service is an up and out system.
Mm-hmm.
But it was scary at first because I didn't have the network in New York that I needed, I would say, to even understand what the opportunities were.
Yeah.
I worked in city government for a period of time in New York City government, which was fascinating because New York City has decided the economy of New York City is bigger than some countries.
And mm-hmm.
the amount of complexities with 8.5 million people is rivaling on some small countries. And so I appreciated that. I thought that the sense of camaraderie that existed in State Department and the sense of, frankly, duty to one's country would manifest in camaraderie and duty to New York City.
Mm-hmm.
I think at its best in municipal government, it is like that. But it's not always as common as at State Department, this
yeah.
sense of like giving back to, in this
yeah.
case, the community that is New York. So I did that work for a little bit. I'm now working at a consulting firm called Casera. We help companies do business in New York City. We help nonprofits
mm-hmm.
Secure resources from city council members, from city hall, from state legislators. That's my sort of day job, if you will. So it's very, very much focused on making an impact
mm-hmm.
and modernizing services in New York City and ensuring that nonprofits have the funding they need to provide social services. But I also am on my community board. So I was appointed by the Brooklyn Borough president to be on my community board.
Oh,
and
cool.
That's my public service. So
yeah.
we meet twice a month. We do resolutions just like at the UN. We have votes just like at the UN. It's hyper local. It's interesting. It
yeah.
can be contentious sometimes, but I feel like if I can find commonalities with diplomats from around the world, I can certainly find that with my
yeah.
neighbors.
You're Britain. Like, I've taken on Russia and China. I can do this. That's so interesting. And I think it's really cool that you're showing us that you can also, like, your job doesn't have to be the one and only place where you satisfy every part of yourself. You can do a job that pays the bills and is interesting and intellectually stimulating to you. And at the same time, if you feel like you need to do something else to feel fulfilled as a person, go ahead and do it. There are so many opportunities and so many ways to explore that and also contribute to your own skills. So now you've sort of already demonstrated this to us, but I want to ask you my final question, my favorite question. What does being an American mean to you? And what do you think it demands of us at this moment or in general?
Sure. I think it's a great question. I think that being a citizen of the U.S. means that this is, for me, a land of opportunity and a land that a place that embraces multiculturalism at our best.
Mm-hmm.
I think about the Statue of Liberty and what that symbolizes to Americans and to people from around the world. And then I think about Ellis Island as well, mm-hmm. and how so many folks came here from elsewhere and passed through Ellis Island. And that manifested as recently as a few years ago or even earlier this year with Roosevelt Hotel in New York City, which housed hundreds of migrants, thousands over the last 2 years or so. Mm. So that to me is what it means to be to be a U.S. citizen. It's about embracing opportunity, embracing diversity, and also most importantly about giving back and yeah. being civically engaged. I think that we're a representative democracy, and that provides space for us to engage with our neighbors and yeah. to engage with our government. And I think to your point, you know, there's different ways to do that even after life in public service.
Absolutely.
At a minimum, you can get involved civically in your neighborhood or in your city or town, but at its best, it's a career in public service. And I hope that this podcast, I'm sure, will continue to inspire people to do that.
I hope so. And I think the story that you're telling us about Roosevelt Hotel and reminding us, like, yeah, we have always been kind of, I don't know if I want to call it the myth of America, because it's kind of the unrealized dream, maybe the vision of what we can be, what is possible, and what we aspire to as we try to form a more perfect union is to fully embrace multiculturalism. And what's also true is that we've struggled with it since the very beginning, at sometimes more than others. And I think the fact that justice has been kind of a thread or a through line in your work is really amazing, and that you've already done the thing that I think so many people are trying to do, which is not only invest in service through their careers, but like identify really what is the core element that they personally hold so dear that they want to then implement in every type of work that they do throughout their lives. So I feel like you've already identified like who you are and what is the thing that you want to leave on this planet, which is greater justice for more people. And I am so happy that you've been willing to sit and talk with me about that. And I'm also just so thankful for for your service. I don't know if you heard it from enough ambassadors or senior leaders, but I'm telling you, I really appreciate your service. And I thank you for everything that you did on behalf of the American people and honestly, on behalf of justice around the world.
Thanks, Kate. I really appreciate that. I think I'll just add that I agree with you that the United States is a project. It's mm-hmm. it's unfinished. I believe it was Dr. King who said the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And yeah. I really believe that. And yeah. I think that part of being an American is working on the inside to help mm-hmm. bend that arc in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And that's so funny because I actually just did a speech about that where I was like, you know, I love that quote, except I think it leaves something out because it doesn't tell us how do we bend the arc, who bends the arc. It doesn't just happen, right? And so my favorite MLK quote that I had on the whiteboard above my head in my office at State was true peace is not merely the absence of tension, it's the presence of justice. And I like that because that gives us some real information. Like if you're enforcing peace, a peace agreement, but there's no the parties don't have the will to really make that happen, and there's no move toward greater justice to address the root causes of that conflict, it's not going to stick, and it's not real peace.
100%. I agree with you. You see it in peacekeeping, and, mm-hmm. and you see it even in our own country and in some of our communities, that if there's no justice, there's no peace.
Yeah, it's so true. Well, we will keep trying, and we'll yes. keep talking, and we'll keep connecting. And again, just thank you for being here, and thank you so much for your service.
Thank you, Kate. It's been a pleasure. Mm-hmm.